This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to the special program of Keeping the Faith. We're talking about interfaith relations in Champaign-Urbana area and Champaign County in this part of Illinois. And our special guest is Professor Rajmohan Gandhi, who is the author of a very recent book published just in January of 2007 called Mohandas, about his grandfather. Welcome, Professor Gandhi.
Thank you very much, Steve.
And this is a program which is a bit unusual for Keeping the Faith. We're having it recorded live with a studio audience in beautiful Latzer Hall at the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. We have a number of people here who we're encouraging to join the conversation, and the way they're going to do that is to come forward and sit in this chair when they have a question or a comment, and that way your comments will be heard by our listening radio audience. This program is being broadcast on March 18, and so there will not be any phone calls today to the station from listeners, but hope you do enjoy our conversation with Professor Raj Gandhi. Raj, when did you come to the University of Illinois for the first time?
I came for the first time in the fall of 1997, almost 10 years ago now. This university thought that they would like to have somebody from India as a visiting professor, and I imagine they turned to a computer and which somehow produced my name, and so I was invited, and I came. And I was delighted that I came.
And what was your first impression of this community, this university, in terms of its religious diversity?
I was struck by the diversity that already existed, and I could also see that there was room for more diversity. And in the 10 years that have passed since my first visit. Mind you, I have not been here absolutely continuously. I have been coming quite regularly. I'm a visiting professor who keeps visiting. And during this period, yes, I've seen the diversity expand, and so it's a very heartening situation.
One of the important issues of this time at this place is whether a Hindu temple can be built here in Champaign-Urbana. And I know we have people in the audience today who know about that situation. What is your own religious background?
Well, I am a Hindu. I was born a Hindu, and I was raised as a Hindu, and I've felt no reason not to continue as a Hindu. I'm very glad and happy and proud to be a Hindu. I have a tremendous warmth and respect for Christianity, for Judaism, for Islam, Buddhism. I'm a Hindu. I have not been a Hindu who regularly visits Hindu temples or worships in a particular form or worship a particular idol. As many may or may not be aware, Hinduism offers to its adherents, or the Hindu world or the Hindu tradition offers to its adherents, quite an amazing degree of autonomy. And there are many Hindus who are fervent and regular temple goers. There are many other Hindus who are not.
So there's quite a bit of diversity within Hinduism.
Enormous diversity and numerous fights. There's a lot of conflict resolution called for within the Hindu world.
We had a speaker at Friday Forum at the Y as part of this series on differing faiths in the public arena, conflict and cooperation, earlier in February. Eboo Patel, who is, I know you know, and he is a Muslim and the founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps that tries on this campus and other campuses to bridge that religious diversity and those various religious divides within different specific religious communities, and of course within Christianity there are huge differences, as you've experienced, I know, in India and in this country. But Ibu Patel said that the diversity, the religious diversity, is the one we don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about all kinds of other, racial diversity, political diversity, all kinds of things, but very seldom does religious diversity get discussed in the public arena. Have you found that true in India?
Well, in India, of course, there has also taken place a great deal of violence in the name of religion. I don't say that it's religion that has inspired the violence, but the violence has often been perpetrated in the name of religion. And so the need for religious tolerance and for religious pluralism is widely understood in India. Yes, the religious diversity is a question that is discussed a lot in India, but I agree with Ibu that in this country, and for very understandable historical reasons, racial diversity has taken kind of the front and center position in discussions on diversity. But now, with what has happened in recent years, and everybody knows of the tremendous need worldwide for some kind of bridging of the great divide between the so-called Western world and the so-called Islamic world. So Islam is certainly a question that many people are trying to understand. Although here, too, let me say that when there is talk of religious diversity in the United States, people do speak about Christians and Jews, but I think the Muslims of the world and the Hindus of the world and the Buddhists of the world get less of a hearing in the United States.
The classic book from my college years, which are now a long time ago, was Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. Two varieties of Christianity and Judaism in America, but Islam was not mentioned, Hinduism was not mentioned, Buddhism was not mentioned. And it's only been in my lifetime as an adult when there's been sort of a critical mass of folks who, in this country, who are here representing those religions and who are very public about that and who are joining the discussion.
Well, you know, the very popular and very understandable and I'm sure very useful description, the Judeo-Christian ethic, is in itself, a phrase that suggests that Judaism and Christianity are somehow central to America and every other religion is not. And some kind of understanding of these other religions outside the Abrahamic religions, although now Islam also is an Abrahamic religion, but has not been accepted as part of the kind of traditional ethic of the United States. Although I do know, Steve, that even in the early years, was it Thomas Jefferson, I think, who referred also to the Mohammedans as people who needed to be accepted in the United States. So it's not as if Islam is a completely new thought for the United States, but somehow it's the Christianity and Judaism that have been traditionally, and for perfectly understandable historical reasons, seen as the main religions of the United States. But now, with so many Muslims, so many Hindus, and a great number of Buddhists, the scene is changing, and of course it needs to change.
And there are a number of scholars in the field of religion who say that the very phrase Judeo-Christian is probably a misnomer and is misleading because they are two very distinct and separate religious traditions. And yes, there are similarities, and Christians, particularly from their perspective, like to sort of claim Judaism, but many Jews find that offensive.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm not here as a scholar either
yes,
of Judaism or
right.
of Christianity or of right. the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Let me remind listeners that this is a special program for Keeping the Faith, being broadcast on March 18, but being recorded on the 23rd of February in Latzer Hall at the University of YMCA, and we do have a live audience here. Let me encourage them again to join this conversation. As you have a thought that you'd like to share or a question, a comment, do come up and sit in this chair and we'll have the microphone for you to make your comments, and we do encourage you to join Professor Gandhi and me in this discussion, because it is about, you remember, the local situation in the area of interfaith relations. So all of us in the room are, and listeners too, are experts, but those in the room are encouraged to come and make a comment. Just one at a time in the chair, please. Don't fight over it. Just come up as you will. Professor Gandhi, your book just came out in January, and we were talking earlier about your grandfather's situation. Your book is titled Mohandas, which was his first name.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where does the term Mahatma come from?
Well, Mahatma is a title that was given to him, first of all, by indentured workers in South Africa, indentured Indian workers of South Africa, on whose behalf he waged several battles. It was then also given to him by the great poet Tagore, who has connections with Urbana. His son was a student here, the Indian poet Tagore.
And he visited here?
He visited here. In fact, I think he was here when he first heard of the Nobel Prize that was being awarded to him, Rabindranath Tagore. So Tagore, who was senior to Gandhi in age, also welcomed him as Mahatma. Mahatma is a traditional Indian phrase, and it means great soul, great soul. So that was the title or the prefix or the name given to Gandhi by a great many Indians, and that's how many Indians continue to refer to him.
Now, I've heard already that your book, Mohandas, about your grandfather that was published just last month, 2 months ago, is already on the bestseller list in India.
In India. I have to point out that this book has only been published in India. It's not published in the United States, not so easy to obtain in the United States. But the Lyna Union bookstore was good enough to order several copies, and I believe is ordering some more copies.
I ordered one this morning because I missed your book signing earlier this week. The book sells for $22, but it's quite thick. So how did it get to be so inexpensive?
Well, books in India are priced lower than in the United States. And I think the Indian selling price was 650 rupees. That comes to about, about 15 plus dollars. And then the
shipping,
right. It does
and
add a lot.
The union needs to make a little money, too.
Well, at least not to lose money, I'm sure.
And tell me how you came to write this book.
Well, I've written several books before this, Steve, mostly biographies of Indian political figures, some kind of history of India. It was one of my books. In all my books, Gandhi was a character. In many of the books, he was a major character. He was always there. And then I felt I needed to deal with Gandhi as the main character. I've been thinking about him, about this project for 30 years or so. As I mentioned, he figured in everything I studied and researched and wrote about. And so finally, I had to grapple with the man in all his aspects himself, because he is a tremendous factor. He has been, and I believe still is, a tremendous force in the thinking and in living of India and perhaps in some other parts of the world. Also, his life was lived on a large scale. It was a political life. It was a spiritual life. It was a fighting life. He fought for India's liberty. He fought for Hindu-Muslim reconciliation. He fought for reconciliation justice among the great and divided castes and between the high castes and the so-called untouchables of India. And he had tremendous plans for bringing fresh air and sanitation and employment and empowerment to India. So there were different aspects of his life, all of them extremely fascinating, and I felt I had to understand him as totally, as completely, as honestly as I could, and to present him to readers.
Now, you wrote the book in English.
Yes, I did.
And what do you think of the movie?
Well, the movie was made a long time ago. It's a wonderful movie. But movies obviously can only focus on 6, 7, 8 episodes in a person's life.
Although it's a long movie.
It's a long movie.
Not dull, though. Very, very exciting, actually.
And so many American students of mine here on this campus have seen it in their high school or earlier. And so the movie has brought Gandhi to the attention and understanding of, I would say, scores of millions, possibly hundreds of millions around the world. Last year, in the fall of last year, another great movie appeared in India. It's not yet it's not yet available in the English language, which also has featured Gandhi in a very interesting, unexpected way, and that was also a great box office success. So,
what is that movie called?
It has a name in Hindi, Lage Raho Munna Bhai, which means keep at it or carry on Munna Bhai. Munna Bhai being a quote-unquote criminal in Bombay who encounters Gandhi and then deals with everyday issues in an unexpected and a new way. Carry on, Munna Bhai.
What are the largest misunderstandings about Gandhi?
One, that he was a utopian or a mere idealist, that his nonviolence was merely theoretical, that his ideas are not practical. Whereas in my research, I discover Gandhi to be an intensely practical human being, and indeed a person who was pragmatic. Yes, he believed passionately and strongly in nonviolence, but there were several times in his life when there was a kind of a compromise with violence.
Can you give an example?
Well, in the First World War, he in fact recruited soldiers to fight for the Allies of Britain and against Germany. In the Second World War, he initiated this movement called Quit India, asking the British to leave. But the Quit India resolution drafted by him also said that if the British granted freedom to India, that the Indian government would allow Allied troops to remain on Indian soil, to continue the war. So there were these significant concessions to the need for a compromise on that issue. So his violence was not always, his nonviolence was not always absolute.
We have a brave person who has a question.
Mr. Gandhi, I wonder if you had the privilege of spending a number of years with your grandfather, and I don't remember, and some anything personal about him that you might want to say.
Well, I was 12 and a half when he was assassinated. In the last 2 years of his life, that is, between my age 10 and a half and my age 12 and a half, he did spend a lot of time in New Delhi where I was going to school. So in that period, I saw a lot of him. But it was the interaction of a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy. It was also a time when India was witnessing violence, bloodshed. India became independent during this time, and one of Gandhi's great goals was realized during this time. But India's independence was marred by great violence. He was also very sad because he could not prevent the division of India into two. It was his great hope that India would be independent as a single united country, but as everyone knows, India and Pakistan were created. He was sad about it, but he accepted the division. But he was above all pained by the tremendous violence that took place. So it was in that kind of climate that I interacted with him, along with my siblings and my parents. He was, of course, spending a lot more time with the Hindus and the Sikhs who had come as refugees from Pakistan to India and who wanted to speak to him. He spent a lot of time with the Muslims of Delhi who were sought to be expelled by angry Hindus who wanted to send the Muslims to Pakistan. So the refugees or those who were threatened or those who were in danger were his primary concern. His family were not his first priority. However, during the many minutes we had with him, or I had with him, he was wonderfully affectionate, very warm, very friendly. But I also had the chance in my very early teens, or not even teens, I was 12 or so, to see how he confronted anger and he confronted hate and he confronted violence with great frankness, with great courage. There were many occasions that I was a witness of where people who were angry with him were in close proximity to him and they could have brought physical harm to him. But his demeanor, his attitude to them of complete frankness, as well as warmth to those who were angry with him, was noticed by me even at that very young age by me. And I said to myself that this grandfather of mine who is only available to his family for very limited moments, he's very affectionate when he is available, but he's dealing with these enormous questions and he's dealing with these angry people and hateful people in a way that is very hard to understand or to see how somebody can do it that way. So it was that mix of warmth and courage before hostility that remains in my mind and memory as the most powerful kind of example of what I saw.
And we have another question.
We have such a rich discussion going here of faith and politics all over the world. I'd like to first go back to something that was mentioned and then ask a question. The reference to Jefferson and his interest in the Muslim religion and the fact that he actually owned a Quran has come up recently because the first elected member of Congress chose to borrow that copy of the Quran to take his oath of office on. I thought this was tremendously interesting in light of the current controversy among religions. And it says that history has much to offer, not just as an example, but actually a physical resource of a Quran upon which to take the oath of office in 2007. But the question I have goes back to the question of violence in the name of religion that has been already raised here earlier. It seems to me we have the dilemma, and I wonder how either of you or how your grandfather Gandhi would respond to the fact that people have to learn to live together, but because they have different beliefs and because they have such strong convictions about their beliefs as sometimes exclusive, which seems to warrant violence or conflict, how do we overcome this in practical ways? How do we theologically in our local communities help to overcome the exclusiveness that religion seems to promote by the conviction or the theology of belief?
Well, the exclusiveness of which you speak is sometimes excluding people socially, or they're not in our discussions, in our conversation, in our discourse, and that is bad enough. Those who are excluded bound to notice the exclusion. But I think more serious than even the exclusion is the impression that exists in this country among many people, in particular, particularly in relation to Islam, that Muslims are not only worthy of exclusion, that something is inherently flawed about Islam, and that Muslims are somehow innately, they present some kind of hazard to American life and society. It's more serious than exclusion. It is some kind of mistrust. It's a misunderstanding. It is a almost as if there is a horrible flaw attached to a section of humanity, which goes against the notion that every human being is, in some respects, a child of the Almighty, Certainly, every human being is deserving of respect and dignity, but not Muslims. And of course, you have a counterpart of this in many Muslim countries, Muslim majority countries, where Americans or Christians or Jews are treated or thought of in that manner. Yes, all Muslims may deserve civil rights and human rights, protection, respect, dignity, but not Christians, not Jews, not Americans. But to have a counterpart of that in the United States at this stage, where a suspicion is cast on every Muslim, is a very unfortunate and serious situation. And if we actually believe that compatibility between Muslims and non-Muslims is impossible, then we are prescribing tension and violence in city after city, state after state, country after country, in the whole world. We can't accept that. It's absolutely out of the question for the world to accept this kind of permanent and incurable hostility. And we know, of course, that hate-filled Muslims believing in terrorism, are a tiny, 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 tiny minority. The vast Muslims are just like Steve and myself, like all of us here, and that they have their families, they have their loved ones, they have their values, they want to live at peace with their neighbors, they want to be of service to the community where they live. And I've had the privilege of meeting with, working with many Muslims, not only in India, but also in the United States, and indeed here in Urbana-Champaign. And they are a tremendous force for the good in this community. So I'm very glad you asked that question because, okay.
I just didn't want you to hit the table. Sorry.
Okay, all right.
You're speaking very emphatically, and that's great, but it sounds bad on the radio, sorry.
I think that this issue of the divide between the Muslims and the non-Muslims is a great issue that we have to address and deal with.
Thank you so much for that very powerful statement. Let me remind watchers on television and listeners that this is a very special program, and it's being broadcast at three different times. So for those of you who are watching on television and who are listening to WEFT, coming up on Friday Forum next week, March 2nd, is Jonathan Ebel, professor of religious studies at the University of Illinois, and he'll be talking about religion and violence and American redemption, very much tied to what Professor Gandhi, the point he was just making. So that's a program at the University YMCA, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign at noon on Friday, March 2nd. If you're listening to this program that's being recorded for later broadcast on WILL AM 580, Keeping the Faith, this program is being broadcast on March 18. And if you're listening to this on March 18, the next program coming up in the Friday Forum series at the University Y, our guest will be Cynthia Campbell, who is president of McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. She'll be speaking Friday at noon at the Y on a Christian approach to religious diversity. Later in this Friday Forum series, Don Shriver will be speaking, former president of Union Theological Seminary in New York City, on forgiveness and politics and ethics for enemies, which should be a fascinating discussion. That's April 6th at the University YMCA on the University of Illinois campus. If you have questions about any of these programs, do call the Y at 217-337-1500. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the director of the University Y and the usual host for the Keeping the Faith programs on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the College of Communications of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We have another a person with a comment or question for our guest, Raj Mohan Gandhi. Go right ahead, please.
I think we recognize that one of the causes of conflict between adherents of different religions is the drive to convert others. I want to talk about the reverse, though. the fact that religious communities need to conserve and to maintain the faith community and its integrity. And certain tensions arise when you feel like your faith community is being co-opted or diluted or dispersed, so that we become preoccupied with the preservation of the faith community that has a great importance and meaning for us. I'm thinking of a family here in Urbana who has a Protestant Christian background, and I think three daughters, and suddenly the parents were discovering that one daughter was seriously involved with a Hindu, another shortly became involved with a Jew, and the family said, well, hey, what's happening? How did I fail to inculcate the meaning of my faith to my children? So I think there's a fear of diversity that we tend to want to affirm these days, when it will begin to impact the life that we share with those who are most dear to us.
And Professor Gandhi, if you don't have all the answers to this, I notice we have some professional family counselors in the audience that we can call on.
I think that's a very major point that has been made, and I think it applies now to so many all over the world, because people are traveling into other cultures, they're running into other cultures wherever they live, and there's more of a chance for people to get to know, get to meet, fall in love with, want to marry people of other religions, other races. And obviously this does at times pose questions to the parents concerned. I don't know whether one can say that if my son or daughter wishes to marry somebody outside the faith in which they've been raised, that it is some kind of failure that that I'm guilty of. I think as long as the person who is about to marry my daughter or son is a person of strong character, of commitment to my child, and is of service to and help to the community, I think it's a tremendous thing to welcome and not to be unhappy about. Of course, we can be unhappy as far as our children are concerned on so many grounds, and marriage to people of other religions is sometimes only one of the rare cases of discomfort or unhappiness. But I would say that this is going to be a real issue with so many people all over the world. So many people, Hindus or Muslims, who send their children here also find that their children fall in love with or wish to marry Christians or Jews, and the Hindu parents and Muslim parents also have similar questions in their minds, Buddhist parents. So it does force us all to rethink what really we regard as important. Of course, there is so much in all our cultures that should be preserved, conserved, respected. It'll be a tremendous tragedy if the great truths on which we have been raised disappear. I don't myself think there is any great danger of Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Hinduism vanishing from the face of this earth, whatever may happen to some of our children. I think these great traditions will continue in this world. And let us hope very much that these new alliances, unexpected alliances, will enrich everybody concerned.
As a Christian pastor of a Protestant church on this campus that happened to have us lovely center aisle and a wonderful pipe organ and beautiful stained glass windows, I was often called upon to perform weddings for folks who may not even have been connected to McKinley Presbyterian Church, where I was for several years. But I felt that it was an opportunity to practice the Christian virtue of hospitality. And so, with the permission of the church officers, I was willing to perform ceremonies which were interfaith, where one of the persons was a Christian and the other was Jewish or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever. And that was often very much appreciated by couples who in that situation were having difficulty finding someone who would perform such a ceremony. In my conversations with the couples that I was asked to perform their wedding, I always encouraged the Christian half of that pair-to-be to convert to the other faith. I felt it was the Christian thing to do. I wasn't always able to be persuasive, but I made what I thought was a good theological argument, that one of the most basic Christian notions is to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And if you would want them to consider converting to your faith, you, of course, should volunteer to convert to theirs. As I say, I wasn't always successful, but in spite of the smiles in the audience, I was quite sincere.
Well, I certainly hope that the Hindus and the Jews and the Muslims marrying into Christian families will really also make the effort to learn more about Christianity and vice versa. So I hope that this, I'm very glad, Steve, that you are being so extraordinarily charitable and unselfish. At the same time, I think this is worth saying that those who come from other parts of the world to the United States and who do run into some traditional Jewish or Christian cultures will also make the effort to understand and respect and honor these local cultures in addition to fighting for rights and inclusion and acceptance of the cultures that they bring.
Let me remind listeners on WILL that this Keeping the Faith program is unusual. We are not accepting phone calls today. This is a pre-recorded program. But we do have another question from one of our guests in the live studio audience.
My question's of a more personal nature. What was it like to be the grandson of such a tremendous figure in world history? And did you ever feel maybe like it was unfair that there were expectations for you to be one sort of a person when you really wanted to go a different direction? I guess that would be from the perspective of an American. Thank you.
First of all, let me say that I really do not know what life without being a grandson of Gandhi is really like from the inside. The only life I know is as Gandhi's grandson. Secondly, so I can only imagine, of course, but I haven't experienced that life. But looking at it quite objectively, yes, there is a downside, there are minuses, and there are expectations. A brother of mine once put it something like in this form, that if you do something quite decent and good, people say, well, hardly surprising, he's Gandhi's grandson anyway. And if you do something that's not expected, well, how dare he as Gandhi's grandson? Well, I think he said that it was a clever remark, but I'm not sure that it's really such a bad thing being Gandhi's grandson. I have only received friendship, warmth, respect. People have been interested in me. Doors have been opened to me. So I can't complain. I have been very grateful that to me it is a blessing. It has not been a hardship or a pain.
Tell us a little bit about the family. How many children, how many grandchildren? No. How is Indira Gandhi related? Things like that.
Well, Gandhi had four sons, no daughters. The four sons are all dead. The daughters-in-law are all dead. There were 15 grandchildren. 9 grandchildren are living. And, of course, there are innumerable great-grandchildren, including quite a few living in the United States at the present time. One or two in the UK, there's one in Australia. Most of them, of course, are in India. So it is. And then in addition to his own sons and their children, Gandhi always had the support of and partnership of a number of other relatives, including cousins of his or nephews and nieces of his. So there are a great many Gandhis with direct connection to him who are around in this world, plus a great many non-Gandhis without whom he could not have achieved what he achieved. He owed so much to so many others who fought alongside him.
Our guest today is Professor Rajmohan Gandhi, who's the author of several books, the most recent of which was published just in January of this year, Mohandas, about his grandfather, Mohandas Gandhi.
Turning back to the local community here in Urbana-Champaign, we have a very rich diversity of campus centers. You mentioned earlier, we talked about Tagore, and when he spoke here in 1912, it was at the Unitarian Church of Urbana, which is now the Channing Murray Center. This community has fostered, again, a lot of different types of activities, and one thing we're proud of is the Tagore Center, which 18 years ago started honoring every fall Tagore's life. And it's a community event and a reaching out. So I think when talking about diversity, education, exposure, and worshiping together in different ways. So again, I'd just like to hear some of your comments, Steve, about our local richness in terms of campus ministries of different faiths.
We have, I notice, in our live audience, Professor Wynton Solberg, who's written the history of not only of the University of Illinois, is in that process, I think, on Volume 3, but has written a number of special papers on the history of religion on this campus for some of the religious foundations that are here. The University YMCA is the oldest of the religious institutions on this campus, was founded in 1873, and I say everything about the past with a little bit of hesitation because Winston may correct me, but I'll do the best I can. The Y was a outgrowth, a lay movement of Protestant evangelical Christianity that started in England, came to this country in the early 1850s, first to Canada and then to Boston. By the end of the Civil War, there were people who were going around, particularly the universities, trying to establish YMCAs for young Christian men who were students at the growing state university movement. And there was several started in 1873 around the country, for example, and in the next few years. On this campus, in terms of our topic today of religious diversity, the first challenge came from Roman Catholics in this community. The Protestants had gotten to this part of Illinois first, and there was really a Protestant hegemony here. They had the power and control, and when Catholics started immigrating and sending their children to this university, the University Y and the Protestants who were running the university at that time, Protestant Christians, had to decide, oh, do we welcome these foreigners, these strangers, these people with a different belief system from Southern Europe rather than Northern Europe? And there was great conflict on this campus and in this community and throughout the state of Illinois and throughout the Midwest and other places, as most of you know, I'm sure. However, that bridge was finally crossed, there was a while when Catholics were told not to join YMCAs because they were Protestant institutions, but that changed, and I'm very pleased to say that this YMCA in its own history, Campus Y, helped lead that change in being open to Catholics and others. This why, for example, with the Chief Illiniwek controversy of the week this program is being recorded on the 23rd of February, just a couple days after the last performance by Chief Illiniwek, the very first Indian Native American student at this university was sponsored by this university YMCA. He became a doctor. Some of you read about him in a recent issue of the Alumni magazine of the university, but this Y was very early in encouraging people of other races, other traditions, to be accepted on this campus and in this community and in the civil rights movement later. The first Wesley Foundation was started on this campus. The first Hillel Foundation anywhere in the world was started on this campus. This campus has had a history of being open to different religious groups independent of the university, funded separately, but welcomed here. The Muslim Student Association nationally in this country was founded on this campus and, in fact, in this building at the University of YMCA. The very first, the Muslim students had their Friday prayers here in the Y for many years before there was a mosque. That later grew too big. Since Friday Forum was happening in this room, they had to be in other rooms in the Y downstairs and upstairs. And when they grew too big, they went to McKinley Foundation. And when I was still pastor there, the Muslims were having their Friday prayers at McKinley Foundation and on the second floor there for many years before the mosque was built. But the mosque is the first Muslim mosque at a state university in this country. So we have a rich history here. I'm very disappointed that our Hindu friends are encountering opposition to being able to found a temple here in Champaign from neighbors who are coming up with all sorts of strange ideas for why they were afraid to have a temple next to them in Champaign. And we may have people in this audience who want to speak to that.
May I say a
word? Oh, please do.
The temple.
Professor Gandhi.
I mentioned earlier that I am not a regular or frequent visitor to temples, but I would be exceedingly, exceedingly, exceedingly sad if this temple project that is being developed by so many Hindus in this community, if that is not allowed to take off. I feel that the Hindu community here has so much to give. Of course, much to receive, but a great deal to give. And the Hindus are not a large number at the moment in this community, but they are a wonderful asset to this community. They share the values of the community. They will enhance those values. And of course, India as a country, India is not a Hindu state, but 83% of India's 1 billion people are Hindus. And I think the world will benefit so much from a good, healthy partnership between the United States and India. So there are local reasons as well as global reasons for welcoming a Hindu temple in this community. And I hope very much that any misunderstandings that may exist will be cleared, and that people will see that these are very decent, good people who want to establish good neighborly relations, who want to strengthen the values that are cherished, and who really will be a great asset to this community.
We have sitting in our questioner's chair today in this unusual program, which is being recorded live in February, Professor Bal Gopal, from emeritus professor from the Department of Social Work at the university, who's been an active member of the Hindu Temple Society that has been working hard to find a place to establish a temple. Could you tell us what kind of problems have you had?
Well, thank you very much, Steve. And Raj, I'm really enjoying your comments. There are close to about 200 Hindu families in Greater Champaign Urbana area. Now, Hindu religion does not have any particular kind of set agreed upon rituals or rules. In other words, it is one of the most non-dogmatic kind of a religion. Swami Vivekananda, who first came to this country in the latter part of the 19th century, and he was addressing the World Congress of Religion. And it was an interesting comment he made. He says that people talk about we should have a religious tolerance, but to call Hinduism as a tolerant religion is blasphemy. And everybody was shocked. And he says, tolerance is a passive acceptance. Hindu religion is 100% accepting of all other religions and not just tolerant. Today we are talking about Mahatma Gandhi's grandson and his new book. Gandhi, in his prayer, which was a very favorite prayer of his, we call them bhajan, a hymn, Raghupati Raghav Raja Ram, which is loosely translated that, you know, the king of all, the universe type of things. And in that, a reference to Allah and Jesus and Guru Nanak and Zoroastra, every religion comes, and that particular hymn is sung in practically every Hindu temples. So it is an accepting religion. Now, the problem which we have having is that people usually try to see that, you know, that there is mostly misunderstanding, not knowing what kind of a institution we are trying to build. They're now bringing up issues such as traffic, the noise, whether we'll keep the place clean, and so on and so forth. And Steve was a very vocal advocate on our behalf in our last hearing. Our forthcoming hearing, which has been postponed, and the new hearing date is on March 15th, and that will be held in the Brookins Administration Building on Washington Street in Urbana. And so a crowd like this, when they can come there and speak, as Raj very eloquently put it, that how much it will be an asset will be certainly a helpful in our getting the special permit. Thank you.
And the location for that is proposed for the Hindu temple is on North Mattis, a couple miles north of Champaign, near a kind of a high-end subdivision, and some of the folks there have been expressing objections to there being a temple in that part of the community. But part of Hinduism is appreciation for nature and appreciation for the environment.
Very much.
And they want the people who want the temple there are hoping to take advantage of the fact that it's on the edge of town and open to the rural area, which is peaceful and quite beautiful on the prairie.
I think the Hindus worshipping in that temple and assembling there for enhancing their own community's relationships within itself, but also with the neighborhood, will only strengthen the wonderful values of rural Illinois or of state of Illinois, and of this amazing country. I would be a very, very disappointed person indeed if misunderstandings were to prevent the emergence of this cherished, long-standing wish of so many significant members of this community.
Since this is a very important local issue, tell us a little bit about some of the Hindu practices. I know Hindus don't have a regular set worship time, like there's not a Friday prayer like Muslims have, or the five prayers a day that Muslims have, or for Christians there's not a Sunday morning service. Hindus can worship at any time, individually or in small groups, families, at home.
Yes, they can. Although the Hindu community in the United States has also adapted itself to the American scene, and Sunday being a holiday, I think in many temples across the United States, many Hindus do meet on Sundays, and the Hindu children are taught the basics of Hindu religion also on Sundays. But you're quite right. The Hindu religion does allow for a great amount of liberty and freedom, depending on what suits and what works for different people in different situations. Baal mentioned in his intervention these devotional songs, or bhajans, as they are called in India, loosely translated as hymns, but these are very warm prayer songs addressed to the Almighty. I would say that these devotional songs are in many ways almost a central feature of Hinduism, and they express the human being's need for the Almighty's grace and protection. They also express the human being's wonderment at the amazing creation in which human beings live, including the environment, and they and they refer to the need to feel the other person's pain as much as you feel your own pain, and that a virtuous person is only he or she who feels somebody else's pain. This is one of the favorite bhajans of my grandfather Gandhi's, but it is something that so many Hindus sing. And these bhajans will be sung in any temple, but of course they will be sung graciously, peacefully, harmoniously inside the temple. It will not create any kind of problem for the neighbors.
We're down to our last 2 minutes for this recording, which will be broadcast on WILL AM on March 18 and on WEFT in a week or so, and on Urbana Public Television. Since one of our questioners mentioned interfaith marriages earlier, we have a very short time, but tell us a few important parts of a Hindu wedding. The last one I participated in, Nora Jones sang. I know that doesn't happen always.
The 7 steps taken by the bride and the bridegroom together around a fire, that with many Hindus is a central feature of the wedding. And those 7 steps actually taken together to the chanting of certain texts that solemnizes a wedding. But they're also solemnized in other ways. And of course, Hindu weddings, I mentioned the 7 steps as a crucial component of the wedding, but the ceremony may take 7 days. It may start several days before this event and continue several days after.
And good food is an important part of it.
And lots of it.
Let me thank our guest, Rajmohan Gandhi. Professor Gandhi is director of the Global Crossroads Project here at the University of Illinois, a visiting professor here. He's the recent author. His most recent book was published just in January of this year, Mohandas, about his grandfather, Mohandas Gandhi, available at the Illini Union Bookstore for only $22. They're sold out at the moment, but has been ordered from India. It is in English and is on the bestseller lists in India. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants. These days, everybody wants to make a movie. And with today's technology, just about anyone can. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the rise of the indie film. Chris Gore talks about My Big Fat Independent Movie. And screenwriter David Mamet on what the Hollywood biz is and the blockbuster he'll never make. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Monday on Focus 580, our guest will be Vikram Chandra, author of the much-talked-about crime thriller Sacred Games. It's a sprawling epic set in Bombay, and it follows one of the city's police investigators as he looks into the death of a major crime lord. The book also tells the life story of the dead mob boss, narrated in first person from beyond the grave. These and many other characters live in a complicated web of social relationships where the line between good and evil is constantly shifting. I'm David Inge, the host. Focus 580, Monday morning at 11 here on WILL. Urbana.
Support for WILL comes from World Gourmet Foods, now celebrating their first anniversary on Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington. World Gourmet features daily tasting, and on Saturday, April 14th, an extended tasting of more than 200 items, including unique honey, organic meats, jams, and fruit preserves. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222.